Yep, I think I am. Good morning, everyone. Can you all hear me at the back?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Cool. We'll kick this off. Just briefly about myself. My name's Paresh Khatri. I work for Alcatel-Lucent. I work within the CTO for the IPD the IP division within the APAC region. So I work with customers in the region to get some idea of their requirements going forward and use that to drive the strategy in terms of product development within Alcatel-Lucent. The key focus is in the IP space, so with our IP products. Prior to that, I've worked on, I spent a couple of years working on the architecture for Telstra's transformation project, Titan, in Australia. So there I was responsible for designing the IP and PLS network for Telstra. All right, so I'll sort of kick that off pretty quickly. The agenda for today, what I really want to cover is some of the aspects of developing high availability for IP networks. The focus of this is mainly on an end-to-end view of how we come up with a network that is capable of offering highly available services. But I will also cover some of the more recent sort of developments in that space, which make it a bit more easy and more possible to get high availability out of your network. So straight into it. Now the drivers for high availability. So as I mentioned, one of the things that I do in the region is work with customers. And increasingly what I'm finding is that one of the top requirements they have is to have a network that has five nines availability. Now, that number has been sort of bandied around a fair bit. And it seems to be something that people like to have without actually understanding what it means. So we'll look at some of the aspects, some of the considerations that go into coming up with a network that can actually achieve five nines availability. So what I've got on the screen is a survey that was done just over a year ago among some of the Tier 1, Tier 2 operators around the world in terms of what they see as priorities for the network that they will be building over the next 3 to 5 years. And we can see that what actually comes out on top is high availability with non-stop services. This is pretty all-encompassing, actually. The things that go into this are, firstly, that five nines availability that I spoke about. The second one is having SDH-like restoration capabilities. So you see that in the shift from TDM to the packet world, what we've gained is a lot of bandwidth, a lot of flexibility in terms of traffic engineering and so on. But there's a potential to lose some of the capabilities we have in SDH, such as rapid restoration, sub 15 milliseconds restoration and so on. So that has become a very critical requirement for most of the IP networks being built by Tier 1s around the world, is to have that 50 milliseconds restoration available as part of the transformation of the network. Now, I will not actually spend too much time talking about that. I'm focused more on the five nines aspect of building networks. All right, so as network guys, we tend to be very focused on bits and bytes, not too much on the actual service that the customer is getting. So the point I wanted to make here as part of this slide here is that the concept of availability has to really come from the actual end user services. So what are we putting on networks now? And what does, say, a 2 second outage in your network translate to in terms of outage to the application that the customer is actually using? So it's quite important that we keep that in mind when designing our networks, that it's not just about what's happening at layer 3 and below, but also what's happening all the way up to layer 7. The focus on high availability was pretty much driven by the business community. We had business services that required highly available services to make sure that the business could go on. But that model has changed somewhat. We still do have that strict requirement from businesses to have that availability. But that's also moving now into the residential space. Because the IP network that we have now is carrying not just your internet traffic, it's carrying your voice traffic, it's carrying video traffic and so on. So while IP traffic, when used for internet type applications, may have been a lot more tolerant to a few milliseconds of data loss or hundreds of milliseconds of data loss, the same does not apply to your voice and your video traffic. So it's pretty critical that we now apply that concept to all the different types of services carried on the network. The impact of downtime is pretty obvious, but I've just sort of summarised that in this slide here. There's a cost associated with repairing a service that is broken for whatever reason. So there's an operational cost to you as an operator. There is also the impact of SLAs. So if you exceed the allowances within the SLAs that you have to your customer, then you end up paying money to them. The second one, probably the most important one is a perceived loss of face in terms of your position in the market. So if an operator is susceptible to lots of outages and so on, that really ends up having a negative effect on churn and so on within your network. So it's all pretty bad. So looking at high availability for IP networks, we've got a few different availability targets that we've had to deal with over the years. And the reason I put them down in this slide is to give you some indication of exactly what we mean by that, right? So when we had the traditional IP networks built on, I would say routing equipment that wasn't quite carrier class, we could probably aim for something like 99.9% 3.9s, maybe 4.9s. Even having an availability of 3.9s translates to an outage of only 8 hours 46 minutes in a year. That's not really much, is it? To design a network to even satisfy 3.9s is pretty hard. So if you come down to where we are today, which is the 5.9s that has been, that has become the de facto availability requirement out there, then we see that results in an outage of only 5 minutes and 15 seconds in a year. Now that is even harder to achieve. So what we need to do is come up with a number of mechanisms on a number of fronts in order to be able to achieve that very high availability target, which is what I'll be talking about today. All right, so the key components that make up a highly available network. First of all, we need to have resiliency within your routers themselves. So you need to have redundant routing planes, redundant switching fabrics. You need to have redundant power supplies. So the first part is really to do with hardware. You start off with hardware that has pretty high mean time between failure. At the same time, it's got to have a low mean time to repair. So these are the inherent things that are part of whatever hardware you're picking, right? You have to get that right, because if you don't, then there's going to be a direct effect on the availability that you can support in your network. The second one is you've got to have capabilities to support things such as non-stop routing and non-stop services. I'll talk a little bit more about this in detail later, but this is more to do with what happens when items on your box, when cards in your box actually fail. How does the box handle it? So we started from here, and typically you'll find that the resiliency, the availability of a single box needs to be something around 7.9s in order to achieve that 5.9s within your network. So pretty stringent. The next bit here is the network resiliency. You've got to have a mechanism for detecting failures quite rapidly. There's no point having a reconvergence protocol that converges in 50 milliseconds if the time it takes you to detect a failure was 3 minutes, right? Because it adds to the total time. So that needs to be pretty critical. The next one is, of course, you need to have rapid reconvergence mechanisms. So we need things like finely tuned IGPs. We need to use features like MPLS fast reroute, and going forward, IP fast reroute as well, in order to get that high level of reconvergence, the quick reconvergence that we require. And finally, you need a resilient network design. We need networks with redundant links, with links going over diverse, with links that have diversity, right? So you don't have any single points of failure in your network. So it all goes together to build up a network that can support highly available services. So this is not really easy, but it's not a black art. It's pretty straightforward in terms of the process that you need to follow. But there is a process, and this is not something you can simply go into your CLI and say, you turn high availability on, and everything works. So it takes a bit of takes a bit of effort. Right, so, okay, I think I've already said that. I'll skip it. So the first element, Raptor resiliency. I will not talk too much about MTBF and MTTR. I think that's pretty obvious. You need to ensure that is up to the mark. But what I really want to talk about on this slide here is the evolution of the resiliency capabilities of routers over the years. So basically, we'll go from the beginning, which is I guess whenever, right? Up to today. And firstly, looking at the actual mean time to repair. Now, when I talk about mean time to repair here, basically I'm referring to your network's capability to self-heal. So we've come from a time where it would take minutes to now a time where we need the network to converge in milliseconds. So looking at what the evolution has been like, the first phase of that was reconvergence based on your protocols such as your IGP. So we've always sort of had that with your IGP, and the philosophy back then, this is talking 15, 20 years ago, was not to concentrate so much on the box itself. If the box fails, the network wraps around it and life goes on. And that's not work, right? That worked when the reconvergence time of a few minutes was acceptable. Doesn't really work now. So the next step in the process was non-stop forwarding. Now this is a time where routers became a bit more carrier class. They had two control plane modules, two switching fabrics, and so on. So when a single control plane failed, the switching fabric populated, the forwarding information base in the switching fabric that was populated by the control plane would continue to be used while the other control plane is booting up. Graceful restart took that a step further. So with graceful restart, the IGP neighbors or the BGP neighbors of the router with the fault assist that router to come up by helping it to reacquire its control plane information. The next two steps in the process are that of, first of all, non-stop routing. So this is evolving to a situation where we not only use the forwarding information that was populated by the active control plane, but in fact we have the control plane cards synchronizing with each other. So every time there's a change to the active control plane, it mirrors that change to the standby control plane. So if the active control plane dies for any reason, the secondary control plane can take over without having to reacquire that information. Now that is pretty powerful for obvious reasons, because that means you're up and running straight away. As soon as there's a fault, there's a standby control plane that can take over. So that's the non-stop routing concept is applicable to routing protocols. So things such as your IGP, BGP, MPLS, for example. The concept of non-stop services takes it one step further. So if we can mirror the control plane information for routing protocols, surely we can do something similar for our services. And when I say services, I mean things such as, for example, your layer 3 VPNs, the routes populated in your layer 3 VPNs, things such as your multicast forwarding information, IGMP snooping information, and so on. So if we can replicate that as well, what we now end up with is a network that can not only route when there's a failure, but it can also support the same services and continue operating seamlessly after a control plane switchover. So that's where we are now. That's as an illustration of the difference between graceful routing and non-stop routing. If we have a look at this figure here on the bottom left, what we have here is a router that supports graceful restart. We've got a bunch of routers connected to it that support graceful restart helper functionality. And that's basically functionality that helps the restarting router to get back up to speed on what the network has been doing. So what happens here is the yellow box there represents the active control plane. Now say for some reason that dies, and the green one, which is the standby one, takes over. What that router now has to do is a couple of things. Firstly, because it's already got a copy of the forwarding information base, it can continue forwarding traffic. So these routers that are connected to it know that, look, there's a problem here, this guy is booting up, but it's still safe to send traffic to it because he can still route. So they keep sending traffic to it. At the same time, this the green control plane is booting up. It's talking to its neighbors and acquiring the routing information in order to bring its control plane up to date. So that's great for restart. Now, there are a couple of problems with it. One of them is that while it's acquiring this information, we kind of hope that the network is not undergoing any change. Because if it does, then that means that the forwarding information base that it's been operating with is no longer valid. So you have potential issues such as traffic blackholing, you have transient loops happening, and so on. So there's a bit of a danger with grateful restart. The second thing is that it then drives the CPU utilization of its neighbors, because all the neighbors have to now participate in this in bringing up this router. So that's great for restart. But I mean, it still does work pretty well in quite a few environments. Non-stop routing, on the other hand, is something that operates autonomously. When the yellow routing, the control plane goes down, the green one takes over seamlessly. There is no interaction with any of the neighbors. The neighbors do not perceive any fault in the network, and things keep operating. So you can see where the benefits are of using non-stop routing compared to graceful restart. All right, so this is just to show you what actually happens when there's a restart event. On the left, we've got the graceful restart scenario. So we see that, the colors don't look very good there. There's a dotted, a dashed yellow line there that depicts the CPU activity on the neighbors of the restarting router. So we see that when there's a restart event, a control plane switchover, the neighbors get pretty busy trying to help the router come up. At the same time, the green line shows what's happening on the router itself in terms of forwarding new prefixes that are being learned. While it's doing that, it undergoes what is called headless forwarding, which is really forwarding based on potentially stale information. So while it learns, there's a period where it's not actually operating at 100% capacity. It's not able to route to all of the new destinations that are being learned. So it takes a little bit of time for it to get to the point where it can actually catch up with the rest of the network. The same applied to non-stop routing results in a much greater or a much shorter time for the router to come to 100% forwarding capability. So and at the same time, we can see that there is no impact on the neighbors of the router. So non-stop services, I think we've already spoken about most of this, is really taking that one step further, applying it to your IP services, your VPN services, your video services. It's a pretty big exercise, right? Because there's a lot of state associated with the actual services riding on top of your IP network. So there's a bit of work involved in making all this work. But when it does, then what you get is the potential to have less than 1 microsecond failover between the formerly active control plane and the newly active control plane. And it kind of depends on the service, but in the worst case, you'd be looking at some like a few milliseconds of outage time. Okay. All right, so that's router resiliency. All the stuff that I've talked about so far is what happens on a single box. The next part is obviously the network resiliency. How does it interact with the rest of the network? How do we configure it so that it can actually reconverge quickly? So just an example of a network design. There are a number of considerations when coming up with an architecture that is capable of supporting high availability. So we obviously have to look at the geography, the availability of diverse transmission, how much you're willing to spend, what are the SLA requirements of your customers, translate that into the SLA requirements of the actual network, analysis of single points of failure, pretty hard. It gets pretty hard once you get down to the physical layer. So you've got to ensure that there aren't any common ducts. If you're using two upstream providers, do they have any single points of failure between them? There are quite a few sort of different considerations. The cost and the strategy for redundancy. In general, you would want an architecture somewhat similar to this, where you do have routers backed up by other routers. But at the same time, not every operator out there has the capacity to be able to support multiple redundant links running empty half the time, just in order to take the load when there's a failure in the network. So hand in hand with that goes your quasi design, so that when there is a failure and there is diminished capacity in the network, what traffic goes through, what misses out. So yeah, it's quite a few factors involved in the basic network design area. All right, so fault detection. Now, fault detection is an interesting one, because the actual nature of fault detection depends on how nodes are connected. So if you have a look at Sonnet SDA, for example, it's got a very rich OEM toolset. So with Sonnet SDH, we have the capability to detect failures using two things. One, well, many things, but in general, we have the failures resulting in a loss of signal. That's pretty obvious, right? When you detect that, you know the link's down. The second one is failures triggered by OEM. If you're having too many bit errors on the link or something and it's signaled back, you have the capability to bring the link down and reroute. The use of any particular mechanism, once again, depends on whether the nodes are directly attached or whether they go through some intermediate nodes. So if you have a look at this scenario here, if any of these links fails, it's immediately obvious to the other side, because it's lost light if it's a fiber link. If anything breaks in the middle here, things get a bit more complicated, because now you have to propagate that failure notification to the edges of the network. So we need to have tools that actually address both of those things. Now, within transmission networks such as SDH, like I said, the tool set is pretty rich. We've already got all the tools. We only just starting to catch up with things such as Ethernet and IP. So with Ethernet, the development in that space has been IEEE 802.3ah, which is basically OAM for Ethernet in the first mile. And that gives you a fairly rich set of functionality for detecting any problems with an Ethernet link. Within the IP space, what is more typically used is BFE in order to provide you the rapid detection of failures. So I've got an example here of IEEE 802.3ah in operation. We've got two nodes here. And just to make things interesting, what I've done is I've actually put two other nodes in the middle there. So that they're not directly connected. Now, the way 802.3ah works initially is by conducting this process called a capability discovery. So the two nodes send 802.3ah messages to each other. When they initially kick off, they're in a evaluating stage. Evaluating simply means that they haven't quite worked out what's going on, whether I have a neighbor that I can talk to, and so on. When they see a sufficient number of messages returned by the neighbor, the state of the connection moves to a stable state. So, for example, looking at this message here, it's saying remote is stable. That means that this node has detected that its neighbor is stable, and it's also reporting that it itself is stable. So we get to the steady state point where we have stability in both directions. So this three-way handshake, firstly, well, ensures that you do not have things such as unidirectional links and so on. Now, we now have a case where between these two points, there is a failure. Now, the failure is such that it results in both directions of the link going down. Because this link here is an Ethernet link, and this link here is an Ethernet link, right? The only way of notifying this guy that there's a problem here is, well, there is no easy way of doing that right now. So when the link goes down, you can't really tell the other end that it's actually down, short of somehow triggering this interface to go down itself. That's one approach. The other approach is of using 802.3ah. Now, these messages, so carrying on from the last slide, right, these messages, the local stable, remote stable, right, sort of carries on. When the link breaks, the messages sent by either side are not being received by the other. Depending on configuration, so the transmit interval is usually set to 100 milliseconds, and we can configure a multiplier of 2. So that means, right, if you haven't heard from your neighbor in 200 milliseconds, then you can assume he's down. So once the time period expires, both of the nodes declare the other side down. So you've ended up detecting that there is a failure. Now, if he did not have 802.3ah, right, then there is really no way of detecting that there is a failure in the middle, short of using a protocol such as, a failure detection mechanism at a higher layer. So this ensures the principle here is that you want to try and get the lowest layer possible to detect and act on the fault, if you can, because that's going to act on it faster. So the physical layer would always act faster than the link layer, which is going to be faster than the network layer and so on. So in this case here, we're letting the data link layer do its job. The second failure case is a little bit more interesting. In this case here, there is a unidirectional link failure. So traffic from the left node is not reaching the right node. So we can see that the AH messages from the right node make it to the left node, but the ones from the left node do not. So the node on the right declares itself to be in an evaluating stage. Once the left node gets the message saying that the right node is in an evaluating stage, it knows that it's in trouble, the link's down, it declares the port down, and then can inform the higher layer protocols to act on it. So we've kind of covered two of the common sort of problems we have with Ethernet that are now detectable by 802.3ah. BFD is something that does a similar job, except that BFD has the capability to be run over IP, which means that you can run BFD over multiple hops. The thing about Ethernet 802.3ah is, firstly, it runs only on Ethernet, right? It's an Ethernet technology. The second one is that it only runs over a single hop. So Ethernet 802.3ah doesn't really help you with multiple Ethernet hops as such. BFD, on the other hand, does. So, sure. A couple of things you can do with BFD are, first of all, you can associate BFD with your routing protocols. So, for example, your OSPF neighbors. So you tell OSPF to pass on the information on its routing neighbors to BFD. Then BFD starts monitoring those neighbors. So instead of waiting for the OSPF hello timeout now, which could take 40 seconds in a network using default configuration, you now have the capability to detect it in a few hundreds of milliseconds. As soon as BFD informs OSPF that neighbor is down, OSPF can start acting on it. So you get your rapid detection happening that way. So BFD can run with OSPF ISIS, it can run with PIM, BGP, it's pretty flexible, it doesn't really impose any requirements on what protocols it'll actually work with. Two options for running BFD, once again. You have, we have a BFD implementation, I suppose, where the BFD process itself can run on the line card. So when BFD is running over a single link, for example, it makes sense to run it on the line card itself. But then you also have situations where, for example, you're running link aggregation groups, for example, that are running on different line cards. So you have to run BFD centrally from your control plane. So that's really what I mean by centralized and distributed options for BFD. Together, you should be able to cover most of the IP-related faults in the network. And being an IP sort of protocol, you do not have to run this on Ethernet only. It can be any sort of data link layer, as long as it's running IP. Right, this is a similar example to what I had earlier with 802.3ah. One thing you can do when providing a link between two routers is this concept of link level loss forwarding. So in this case here, we've got two routers connected by what is perceived to them to be a single Ethernet link. So let's just say this is an MPLS network, and between this point here and this point here, what we have is an Ethernet pseudo wire. So anything sent by this router here ends up on this router here transparently. So this is basically a long-lined Ethernet tail. Now, if there's a problem within the IP MPLS network, then we have the same issue. How do we actually inform the other side that there's an issue? We can use 802.3ah, sure. But if the equipment doesn't support it, we have another option. We have the option of propagating that failure to the PE devices that connect to the customer routers. Now, once the PE devices get that information, what they actually do is turn off the laser going to the customer, which results in a physical link loss here. So they do not actually need to support 802.3ah. They simply see that as a link down and act on it. So that's another option you have should your customers not support AH. Okay, so very very briefly on 802.1ag, I'm not going to go into it because I'm running out of time here. 802.1ag is primarily concerned with connectivity fault management within your network. It's not really going to help you with high availability, but I've just included it here because it's something new and it's coming up. It's useful for tracing faults in your network, finding out the existence of faults, as well as localizing their location. All right, skip that. IGP, I think we all know about how the IGP works. MPLS, so very very briefly, we've got an environment here with MPLS using RSVPT LSPs. In order to achieve that 50 milliseconds restoration, all we use is MPLS fast reroute. So we have an LSP going from the top router here to the top router here. That's a green LSP. In order to protect against failures of any of these routers, what these routers do is build what is called bypass tunnels or detour LSPs. So this guy here builds a detour LSP to the next hop, the next hop along the way. So he builds an LSP that bypasses this node here in case that node fails. He does something similar. This router builds an LSP to what is actually the terminating node. So if this link goes down for any reason, this router can immediately switch traffic onto this bypass tunnel. When it hits the green LSP here, it gets merged onto that LSP and traffic continues to run. But by taking this action at the point where it detects the fault, we have what is called local repair happening. And local repair is always going to be faster than a repair mechanism which relies on that information being propagated to the rest of your network. So you get your 50 milliseconds performance. All right, with I think that's the last slide. With MPLS as well, you've got two options. You can use LDP or RSVPTE. RSVPT will give you that rapid reconvergence. LDP will not. But there are circumstances such as with LDP over RSVP where you can actually tunnel LDP over RSVP to get the best of both worlds. All right, that was 1 minute, I think. Any questions?
John Brewer here. I find that most of the network failures here are not due to loss of link, but due to performance qualities on links. Uh-huh. Is there any way to stop using, for your network to know, to stop using a link when it starts dropping packets?
There are, but I mean, there is no real standard way, so to speak. So you can use features such as SAA to tie it to the operational status of a link. But it's once again, it's not a standard sort of mechanism. So when you say that, do you mean that manifests itself as packet loss and so on?
Using other carriers.
Right. Right. Actually, there's some interesting work happening in the MEF regarding that. We can have a chat if you want offline.
Well, listen, thank you very much for an awesome presentation.